and welcome to the Triathlon Coach Podcast. My name's Simon Ward and I'm your host for this weekly show where my goal is to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic athletes and coaching them to race at distances from sprint through to Ironman. Reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so if you enjoy today's conversation, I'd really appreciate it if you could drop into iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher and leave a rating and a review. And while you're there, please subscribe to our weekly episodes so that they can be downloaded straight into your phone or your iPad or wherever you choose to listen to them. And finally, to say thank you, I have a free gift for you. I've put together 25 of my top tips amassed from 30 years of racing and training and coaching in the sport. All you have to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she'll send it right out to you. Okay, now it's time to crack on with today's guest. Welcome back, listeners. This is Simon Ward, your host for this weekly Triathlon Coach Swatcast. And I've got a guest today that I know a lot of you have been waiting to hear from. Not particularly this man, but the subject we're going to talk about, which is athletes and their hearts. So, Peter Svoboda, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Simon.
Just as a little bit of a preamble, Peter and I were getting ready and just preparing our script for this show. And Peter said, yeah, we're not going to be disturbed. And then the fire alarm went off. So I think we've been quite lucky. Hopefully we won't get another recurrence of that, Peter.
Hopefully not.
So, Peter, I've known Peter for quite a few years now, actually. I helped him out on a couple of research studies that he's been doing here at the General Infirmary in Leeds in the cardiac... What do you call this bit here?
Cardiology unit. Department, yeah.
Okay, in the cardiology department. So Peter is a consultant cardiologist. He's also a senior lecturer at the University of Leeds.
Yeah.
And you were talking about three significant studies you've had published, Peter.
Yeah.
The first two were really health-related, but still significant. The relationship between fitness and heart size,
yeah,
and also the quality of that heart size,
right.
So not a swollen, distended
right.
heart from disease, but one that's responded well
right.
to exercise.
So I'll tell you about, so the first study that you helped us recruit people for was really looking at young athletes, and we looked at the relationship between heart size and fitness. So we got, I think, 60 young athletes down, mainly triathlon and cycling and running, so endurance athletes, really. And we did exercise tests with VO2 max on the cycloergometer, and we did cardiac MRI, which is my main area of interest. And we looked at the relationship between how fit these young athletes are and the size of their heart. And we showed that as you get fitter, your heart's getting bigger. But the thing that we showed that was new for the first time was that we showed that as it gets bigger, the quality of the heart muscle is also improving. So it's the heart muscle is getting bigger and healthier. And if you compare that to disease, where patients often have a big heart muscle, in those cases, the heart is big but unhealthy, and there's often scar tissue in the heart that you can detect. So we're able to show that these athletes have big hearts, but they're big and healthy, and that was the first study we did.
When you were showing that those hearts are bigger,
yeah,
is it the whole heart or is it just part of the heart that's responding?
Everything gets bigger. When an athlete's heart gets bigger, it gets bigger symmetrically, so all the chambers get bigger.
When I was studying to be a personal trainer, we often used to talk about the fact that the left ventricle, which is the chamber of one of the four chambers of the heart that pumps the blood out to the rest of the body,
yeah,
tended to respond more and grew larger. Are you saying that that's not the case?
They all do respond, all four. There's some interesting data that suggests that they take different amounts of time to respond, and perhaps the left ventricle is one of the one that responds the quickest, and perhaps after only a few months of training you can make the left ventricle bigger, whereas the other chambers perhaps take longer to respond. But the evidence is still not entirely clear on that.
Now, I'm really interested in this second study,
yeah,
that you did. We call it the broken leg study.
Yeah.
And I'll let you explain a little bit more about that one.
Right. So this is we've presented preliminary data from this in Munich last year, and we're hopefully going to get it. It's hopefully going to be published very soon. And we've got 28 young athletes who were mainly footballers who came to the A&E department with a broken leg, and we did a heart scan on them within a week of their broken leg, and then a month later, and then 3 months later. And we did various other tests and assessments at the time. And the thing that we showed in these young athletes was that after a month of going from, on average, they were doing 7 or 8 hours a week of training. So after a month from going from 7 or 8 hours a week to nothing, the heart shrunk by 5 or 6% in size. And that was certainly the first time that anyone's ever shown this in such a short period of time. Between 1 and 3 months, there wasn't really much of a change. And that's probably because these people were starting to recover from their broken legs and they were starting to walk a little bit and things like that. But I guess it's harder to speculate on between 1 and 3 months. But we can show that between 0 and 1, there was a definite decrease in the size of the heart.
There is evidence, isn't there, from going back much further than these participants with astronauts, and particularly the early astronauts when they're in space, basically no gravity, doing very little other than their little experiments in the space environment. They really did have significant changes in a whole lot of things, not just the heart, but bone density, muscle mass.
Right. So the heart is trained to work against resistance. The whole time we're awake, we're pumping the heart against pumping against gravity, we're pumping against walking around. And when astronauts are in space, there is no resistance, and the heart shrinks I think it takes just 5 days, and the heart starts to shrink in size. And so I think now when astronauts go up into space, they have to row for several hours a day and really make efforts to keep the heart working against resistance. But that's really exciting research. It'd be something that'd be very cool to be involved in, but
it's probably something we'll come back to later. But this idea that, you know, running on a treadmill doesn't do it because there isn't that much resistance. It's got to be that the exertion against a resistance. So cyclists pushing against the pedals, against the force, rowers pulling against either the water or against the paddle or the motion of the ergometer creates a resistance.
Right.
Is completely different to running. And I think we'll come back when we talk about what type of people are predisposed to heart conditions. Mm-hmm. And we can come back to that later about the significance of resistance in there.
We know that there's quite clear evidence that different types of training put different, make the heart work in different ways. And so probably the athletes who get the most hypertrophy, so the thickest heart muscle, are rowers and cyclists.
Swimmers, maybe?
I'm not sure about swimmers. I think they're probably somewhere in the middle, but it's definitely rowers and cyclists that are the two who get the most hypertrophy of, so the thickest heart muscle. And that's because they have a really high cardiac output, so they're doing real endurance sport against resistance. So the heart is having to pump against contracted muscles. Mm. Whereas if you think about running, your leg muscles are probably only contracted for 5% of the gait cycle. So you really are, your heart's mainly not having to pump against any resistance at all. It's just trying to maintain really high cardiac output to get blood to all the tissues. Whereas when you think about rowing and cycling, you know, in rowing, your probably muscles are contracted for half of the cycle. So you're always having to pump against resistance. And that's why those people are more predisposed to getting.
What about lifting weights then? Because you are working against resistance there, but I guess that the cardiac output isn't that high. So does that not have the same effect?
Exactly. So there was some, I think people have suggested that lifting weights leads to thickening of the heart muscle. I think the jury's out on that one quite so much because they probably don't have the high cardiac output for long periods of time. The other thing with weightlifters is, you know, that when you are lifting heavy weights, you can get very, very high blood pressure. And those things can be influencing factors on the hypertrophy. So I'm not so sure about whether people who don't do endurance sport genuinely get changes in the heart muscle, but there's conflicting literature, I think, is there.
Yeah, I mean, I've lifted weights for most of my life since I was a teenager, and I can definitely state that you very rarely do any form of lifting weights that lasts for longer than a minute, just because the muscles get too fatigued. So it wouldn't be considered to be aerobic exercise, even.
Exactly, and I think that's why there's a debate about whether weightlifting really does cause increase in size of the heart muscle.
The third study that you have been involved with is something that's much more, well, much closer to my heart, I should say, literally and metaphorically, is this study in veteran athletes.
Yeah.
Now, when we did the first study, I couldn't take part because you were looking for young athletes. Clearly, I don't fall into that category.
Yeah.
And I think I might even have persuaded you to change the age bracket so I could get in on this one. But you were looking at the heart structure and how that changes with age and with exposure to what we call extreme endurance exercise over an extended period of time. So can you go into a little bit more detail about that study?
So the thing, I think there's clear evidence that athletes get bigger hearts from training. And the thing that we're thinking about now is whether a lifetime of training can lead to changes in the heart that... Whether some of these changes we can detect, whether they're all positive. So we know that definitely as you know, athletes who do a lifetime of sport are probably predisposed to atrial fibrillation, which we'll probably touch on separately. But there's also this idea that athletes who do a lifetime of sport might also get some scarring of the heart muscle. And what we wanted to do was to try and use, what we're still trying to do is to use really state-of-the-art imaging to try and detect really small amounts of scar in the heart muscle. Now, the question that really remains unanswered is this part of normal physiology? Is this just part of the normal veteran athlete's heart, if you like? Or is this something potentially that we need to look at in more detail? And is this something that potentially could predispose us to heart problems? And the jury is still very much out on this. And this is something that we're hopefully going to answer in coming years. And hopefully there'll be more data from other research sites around the world helping us to answer some of these questions about whether a lifetime of high volume of endurance sport is necessarily all good.
There was a book written, I know you said you hadn't read this, but we can reference it in the show notes, called The Haywire Heart.
Yeah.
And I think that the driving force behind that was because the author discovered that he was suffering from atrial fibrillations, and he noticed this mostly on a ride in Boulder, which is at altitude, and so he was climbing even higher, so the air was getting thinner. And he was then disbelieving of the fact that as a super fit cyclist who was not overweight and been training all his life could develop heart problems. And then when he did that, he discovered that there were lots of other endurance athletes similar to him. And I mean, I can name several triathletes, elite triathletes. Dave Scott won the Ironman 6 times. He's had heart problems, developed heart problems in his late 50s and early 60s. Greg Welsh, who won the Ironman, suffered quite serious heart problems at much younger age. Norman Stadler, Torbjörn Sindvall. There was an English guy who had the Ironman record for many years called Julian Jenkinson, who discovered he had heart problems and sadly died from a heart attack while he was riding his bike. And I guess that triathletes then will be forgiven for thinking, well, if these super fit triathletes are developing heart problems, does that not mean I'm more at risk? And I think in the book there, he was trying to educate people on what heart problems there are, how the heart responds to exercise. So there was an education process and then maybe some of the treatment. So let's talk about that whole thing about, are you more at risk from developing a heart problem if you engage in exercise when preparing for a triathlon or a marathon?
So the first thing I would say is that athletes of any description are still humans, and they're still vulnerable to the same things as everyone else, and so no matter how fit you are, you can still have a heart attack.
So there's, you said to me that there's probably about 1% of the population suffers from heart problems and atrial fibrillation. So there's no reason to believe that triathletes or endurance athletes, if there was 1% of those, would probably suffer from that as well.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So atrial fibrillation is slightly different in that atrial fibrillation does have a relationship with endurance sport. And you have to, if you do a lifetime of endurance sport, there is certainly an increased risk of developing atrial fibrillation. In the general population, atrial fibrillation, a lot of patients don't even get symptoms from it. They just get an irregular heartbeat and never actually get any symptoms from it. Athletes are slightly different. Endurance athletes are slightly different because we say that the left atrium contributes 5% to your cardiac output. And when you're an endurance athlete, you need all of that 100%. And you can't really afford to lose those 5%, which probably the general population can afford. So when endurance athletes go into atrial fibrillation, they tolerate it much less well. And we usually have to find strategies to get them out or keep them out of atrial fibrillation.
So those strategies would be like a cardioversion and the ablation techniques,
So the treatment for atrial fibrillation is, if you're in atrial fibrillation acutely, we can get you out by cardioversion. That's putting you to sleep with a general anaesthetic and then shocking the heart back into a normal rhythm.
So acutely means like it's happening now.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, whereas chronically, is it happens regularly over a period of time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's what we'd do if you presented with atrial fibrillation for the first time. We might do cardioversion to get you out of atrial fibrillation.
I always used to think it was a bit like a light flickering. You know, you stop, turn the power off for 10 minutes, correct the wiring, and then turn it back on again, and everything's okay.
Yeah. When you stop it, you're only stopping it for more like 10 milliseconds.
Okay.
It stops and then it comes back on very quickly. And actually, it's very safe, and it's a really, really effective procedure in reverting people from atrial fibrillation to sinus rhythm. Longer term, in the general population, we would normally, if people are in atrial fibrillation, we would encourage them to tolerate it and actually stay in atrial fibrillation. So the vast majority of people don't need to be in sinus rhythm. There's no danger from being in atrial fibrillation. So we'd encourage the vast majority of people to tolerate atrial fibrillation and would give them medications to slow their heart rate down. And actually, the vast majority of patients can tolerate atrial fibrillation with no symptoms at all and can lead entirely normal lives. It's slightly different with the endurance athlete because, as I was saying, you want to get 100% out of your heart. And if you're in atrial fibrillation, you can't get 100% out of your heart. And in those patients, we use a strategy called rhythm control. And rhythm control involves using medication to keep you out of atrial fibrillation. So there are medications we can give, either that you take a tablet when you get atrial fibrillation and it will convert you back to normal rhythm, or you can take it regularly and actually prevent you going into atrial fibrillation. Or there's a thing which you mentioned called ablation, where we put catheters up to the heart from the groin. We put these catheters in via the groin, and then we go into the left atrium where we find these bits of tissue where the extra heartbeats are coming from, and they actually burn those out. That's a very, very effective treatment in patients with atrial fibrillation. It seems to be effective in athletes. The point is, though, it still is a procedure. It still carries risks. All procedures carry risks. And it is being done entirely for symptom control.
And I understand that process, actually, it's so precise that sometimes you don't get the right nerve straight away. I think I know one guy has had at least four, or he was his fourth one before they managed to get the right nerves.
Exactly. And so the success rate for this procedure is about 60 or 70%. Mm. So in 2/3 of patients, it will work the first time. And I think a lot of that relates to picking the right people to be treated with this procedure.
Okay. So do we need to go back to your vet athlete study at all and finish off on that one?
What were we talking about for veterans?
We got to the point where we're saying that they are normal human beings, and there's a good chance that if 1% of the population suffers from AFib, then athletes will too. You'd started to talk about scarring.
Right, yeah. So there is some data from large cohorts, so really large population studies, that suggests that I'd start by saying the simplest thing is everyone should do more exercise. I think that's the simplest message we should tell everyone as doctors, as to the general population, that everyone should do more exercise. And that generally, the more exercise you do, the lower your cardiovascular risk.
So, right, there's not really any circumstances under which more exercise is bad for you. Is that right?
I think there's not really any. I mean, obviously, if you've got a pre-existing cardiac condition, then everything needs to be discussed with your doctor. But in the general population, people who don't have cardiac disease, exercise is good. There probably is a point, however, where you stop getting benefit from exercise. And that really probably only is the very, very high end of endurance athletes who are doing many, many hours a week, where they probably are not getting that benefit. Mm. And they might even potentially be exposing themselves to some harm. The data really is conflicting at that stage.
So that's like the bell curve. You've started off at the bottom of doing no exercise. If anybody doesn't know what a bell curve is, you can go and Google it. But basically, it's a U shape upside down. If you're on the left-hand side of the U on the flat line, you're doing no exercise, and yep. that's worse for you. Yep. Then as you start to exercise, you go up the U, and exercise is beneficial. But there comes a point at the top where if you keep doing more and more exercise, you start to go down the other side, and the benefits are either plateauing or less beneficial.
So I think the what's happening at the very top of that bell, we don't know. And we don't know whether it does plateau or whether it goes down again, and whether actually exercise can be harmful. I would say at this moment in time, the simplest message still to tell everyone is that we should be doing exercise, because I think as doctors, we have a responsibility to encourage the general population to be healthy, and this the cheapest, best intervention that for the general population to increase their cardiovascular health is exercise.
Well, I always think as well that, you know, even if we do more exercise, and is that at that point where we start to get less marginal gains, I can't remember what my economics teacher used to call it, but There's still so many other things in life that could get us. You know, we're riding our bikes and we're breathing carbon monoxide in. We're eating the wrong foods. That could get us. Right. You know, so it's a whole balance, isn't it? There's so many factors and elements in the mix there.
Exactly, and I suspect the fact that the data is so conflicting and that it's so unclear suggests that probably is if it is true, it's likely to be very marginal. But so the thing we're interested in, perhaps at that high end, is perhaps why is this happening? Huh. And that's what we're trying to look at in some of these studies in veteran endurance athletes. There is some early data suggesting that perhaps you can detect some scarring on the heart. And we want to know whether this scarring is part of normal physiology of the veteran athlete, or whether it is something that's potentially harmful. We know that veteran athletes get more calcification of their heart arteries, so hardening of their heart arteries. The jury's again out whether this leads to increased heart problems or not. We've also mentioned atrial fibrillation. Whether this is responsible for this, for the plateau again, we don't know. Probably atrial fibrillation is not. But these are three things that we definitely know in the veteran athletes do seem to get more of, yeah.
I mentioned at the beginning that this study and the work you've done is close to my heart. I've been involved in another study in London where they discovered that I had that increased calcification. According to the normal calcification scores, I've got three times as much calcium than the highest percentile that's recommended for a man of my age. So I think that the highest percentile was around 400 and I've got a score of 1200, apparently. But I don't get any symptoms. And they think I might have a slight blockage in that left anterior descending artery. But again, I'm not getting any symptoms. And that was from a CT scan. Now, in that case, what do I do? Do I carry on, or do I get worried? Or
Let me tell you about, I'll talk about coronary calcification. So in the general population, we know that risk factors, traditional risk factors such as diabetes, obesity, smoking, sedentary lifestyle are all associated with hardening of the heart arteries, with atherosclerosis, we call it, which is eventually narrowing of the heart arteries. And coronary calcification goes with that. And we know that patients who have these risk factors and coronary calcification are at increased risk of heart problems in the future. So that's from the general population. There's also separate data that looks at lifelong athletes, and there's data from London, which I think was mainly marathon runners. I think there's some data from Scandinavia as well, which shows that lifelong athletes actually can have very high calcium levels, coronary calcification. Now, the question that really is unanswered is the mechanism of this the same? You know, is this related to disease risk factors, or is it a physiological response to years and years of endurance training? And I suspect, and there's some speculation on this, that, you know, your heart arteries are perhaps only 4 or 5 millimeters across. And then when you're doing really, really hard endurance training for a long time, you're pumping liters and liters of blood through these tiny vessels. Part of the physiological response to that is probably hardening the heart arteries. There really isn't any data to suggest that hardening of the heart arteries in veteran athletes goes on to increase risk of heart problems in the future. I think that, so then talking about how individual patients should be managed, definitely we should advise on risk factor modification. So just because you're an athlete, you know, you still have healthy diet, you know, green vegetables, reduce saturated fat, all these things that perhaps you can neglect when you're burning, you know, burning 5,000 calories in a day.
And that, I mean, that's, you know, you and I, you're a marathon runner, Peter. I'm a triathlete, but I hang out with cyclists and swimmers and marathon runners. And we both know, because we chatted about this before, that often endurance athletes, because outwardly they're lean, they're fit, they do plenty of exercise, they're burning off the calories, they think that that's an excuse or a reward for them to be able to eat some of those foods that we would say, you shouldn't eat those to the general population because you don't exercise, but I can do. But that's actually no excuse, and it doesn't help with performance. But more importantly, most of these people don't know what's going on other than by looking at their abdominals mostly. They don't know what's going on internally, do they?
We know that visceral fat, we call it, so fat on the inside that you can probably only see on a CT scan or measure on another kind of scan, is associated with cardiovascular risk. So it's possible that you can be skinny on the outside, but you know, have visceral fat.
I call those people skinny fat, by the way, because you know that's what they are.
Yeah, and so that, of course, that's increased cardiovascular risk. And so just because you're burning thousands of calories doesn't mean you should eat unhealthily. Yeah, definitely agree with that.
Hmm. Just going back to this calcium thing then,
yeah.
Where does the calcium come from? I mean, you were talking about whether, you know, people who do what's, again, we're calling it extreme exercise, but because we think that that's normal amounts of exercise, yeah. But really in terms of the medical profession, it goes beyond that threshold. Is there something within the mechanism of exercising that produces and releases calcium? Is it something to do with diet?
I'm not sure of the exact mechanism, but I think it's more to do with the with flow down the vessel. You know, okay. Having high volumes of flow down a vessel, I think the vessel becomes harder.
Do you get minute scarring then that causes stuff to stick to the inside of the artery?
I'm not sure that's a mechanism, but it's not really. I'm not sure.
Okay. Okay, so let's move on then. We talked about the scarring, but that scarring that occurs or that doesn't might be there anyway. It might not be to do with extreme exercise, so that's what you're trying to discover. We've talked about AFib and A-flutter. Mm-hmm. We've talked about coronary calcification. We've talked about scarring of left ventricle. Let's talk about, for somebody who discovers that they have atrial fibrillation as an athlete, mm-hmm. or somebody that discovers that they have calcification or scarring, what, in terms of exercise prescription and going forward, should they be worried about training and continuing on in their athletic career? Should they be stopping doing that form of activity, or do they just need to continue with being more mindful of what they do?
I think it's difficult because every patient is different. I think If you've been diagnosed with something, you do need to see a cardiologist or a doctor and speak about it. Atrial fibrillation or heart artery, coronary calcification or heart artery disease, you do need to speak to your own doctor. The main thing that guides us to how we manage patients is symptoms. And I think that if patients are getting symptoms, the main things we would worry about are chest pain, dizziness, blackouts, breathlessness. If you're getting those symptoms, particularly on exertion, then it needs to be taken seriously.
But if you're pushing yourself hard, you know, running up a hill or doing some high intensity intervals, you're going to get a little bit of chest pain, aren't you? Just because that's to do with the buildup of lactic acid and just the exertion. But abnormal chest pain, we're talking about.
It's a change, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a change. If you're noticing something's changed, then you need to take it seriously.
And I guess that perhaps as endurance athletes, we think we're super normal because we've done a marathon or an ultra marathon or an Ironman. And so therefore we're immune to the sort of stuff that's going to affect the general population. Yeah. But if we do get these symptoms, it's better to get checked out and be given a clean bill of health than to ignore it and have something else develop and become worse.
Absolutely. And as I mentioned to you earlier, you know, we're men, we're middle-aged, there are genetic factors that you cannot change. Just because we do exercise doesn't mean that you're at zero risk of having a heart attack. You can still have a heart attack, and it needs to be taken seriously.
Well, you did mention earlier, and we sort of touched on it there, that there are certain people and certain types of people that are more predisposed to atrial fibrillation and heart issues than others.
Let's
go a bit deeper into that one.
So,
men.
Yeah. So atrial fibrillation is... If stop thinking about people for a moment.
Yep.
We just think about the whole of animals. The main risk factor for atrial fibrillation is the size of your left atrium.
Right.
So I think is it racehorses get atrial fibrillation? And I think someone's told me that blue whales are more or less in atrial fibrillation all of the time. Mice don't get atrial fibrillation. So it's the size of your left atrium that probably is a risk factor for the development of atrial fibrillation. Men... Being a man is definitely a risk factor for developing atrial fibrillation. If you now just thinking about endurance athletes, men seem to get a lot more AF than women. There are certain sports that seem to be associated with AF, such as rowing and cycling.
So that comes back to what we were discussing earlier with regard to resistance.
Yeah.
So working against heavy resistance for long, you know, for extended periods of time in your life, it predisposes you more than if you were a runner or we talked about swimmers being in the middle there.
Yeah.
Or a downhill skier, if you're a downhill skier.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not quite sure. I don't know if the mechanisms are quite the same. I'm not sure. But they're the ones, because obviously rowers tend to be taller as well, and being taller is more of a thing for atrial fibrillation. Being older, you know, so there are all these certain things that probably predispose you to atrial fibrillation.
So females are less predisposed to this.
So I think female athletes, yeah. In the general population, it's probably more or less the same.
I again, going back to my fitness training stuff that I did many years ago, I remember them talking about females in general less likely to develop heart conditions pre-menopause, so in the younger age. But once they've gone through the menopause and their hormones are sort of slightly more androgynous, then they become more susceptible to heart problems. Would that still follow through in athletes?
Yeah.
So older females might be more likely to develop AFib than younger ones.
Yeah, and probably atrial fibrillation, probably the biggest risk factor is getting older.
Right.
And atrial fibrillation, the natural history of atrial fibrillation is that it increases in prevalence as you get older. And probably by the time in the general population, not athletes now, but in the general population, by the time you reach 80 or 90 years old, the prevalence of atrial fibrillation is probably more than 10%.
Mind you, Pete, if we're athletes and we're 80 and we're still training hard and entering marathons, I think probably that's going to be the least of our worries, because
exactly.
We're still standing and breathing.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, and this is quite an interesting link then, is in the previous podcast I did with Joe Freer, we were talking about the types of training and approach to life that athletes need to have once they get into the 40s and 50s. And lifestyle changes, your body is... more sensitive to foods, so you perhaps things that you could eat when you were 20 and get away with. You know, you could, if you've got the talent, you could probably be a world champion existing on less sleep and McDonald's, but not certainly you couldn't do that in your 50s. So we talked about changing approach to nutrition, getting more sleep, maybe doing a little bit more strength training to counteract the sort of aging process of loss of muscle mass and power. And maybe less aerobic work, because if you have many years of aerobic work behind you, you'll probably know better than I do the percentage of training that you can drop down to before we end up like those broken leg candidates.
Yeah.
You know, you can maintain your current aerobic fitness status on less training. So less cardiovascular training, more strength training, maybe more high intensity, maybe a little bit more diligence with high intensity intervals. So not shying away from those just because you're getting old, but a reduction in chronic extreme endurance stuff.
Yeah.
Might also play into making just giving you more of a cushion against the heart problems, yeah?
I think that's probably fair. It's probably not based in strong evidence, but we do know that volume of training seems to be associated with the development of atrial fibrillation. It might be related to coronary calcification and things. So perhaps as you're getting older, cutting back on the volume is not a bad idea at all, and concentrating more on quality rather than quantity.
Getting a bit more rest then, because I guess one thing we haven't talked about is stress. You know, if you're under stress through just life events, through your work where you're always trying to hit deadlines, your fight or flight system, so is that sympathetic nervous system, is engaged nearly all the time, and there's not much activation of the parasympathetic nervous system. And of course, you know, we know that triathletes and marathon runners tend to fill their lives full of stuff and feel guilty if they have spare time. So that fight or flight system will more likely be activated more than the rest and digest. Do you think that has any bearing on the heart as well and on heart health?
So I think the jury's out on stress. I think there is some evidence that suggests that stress can be damaging, and certainly stress can precipitate heart problems. But it's difficult to know whether those people were going to have heart problems anyway.
Mm.
There's a really nice study from the 2006 World Cup, which was in Germany. And every time Germany played a game, there was a big spike in the number of heart attacks.
Right.
In Germany. Every time they played a game. And you can see the prevalence of heart attacks goes up with each match. You know, and I think they got knocked out in the semi-finals. And then so you see in the third, fourth place playoff, the spike has completely disappeared because nobody's stressed about it anymore. But throughout the group stages, the number of heart attacks goes up with each game.
That's quite interesting where you talk about spiking heart attacks. I was listening to a podcast by a guy called Matthew Walker. You may have heard of him. He's written a book called Why We Sleep. And this was a TED Talk podcast. And he talked about the increase in the number of heart attacks and the relationship to sleep. When we have the clocks go forward in the UK, or in, I think he said there were 70 countries, which covers about 1.6 billion people worldwide. So they've done this is a huge study looking at stats from, I guess, from the health services in those countries. This seemed like a staggering figure to me, a 24% increase in the number of heart attacks in the days following a change in that 1 hour loss of sleep. And there's a corresponding fall by 21% when the clocks go back and we get an extra hour of sleep. So that means that the sleep has a massive impact on heart problems, and I guess on stress as well.
Yeah, you have to be a little bit careful with, we'd call this observational data. So you have to be a little bit careful with observational data in attributing cause and effect. But yeah, I mean, there's lots of data that suggests that people, for example, people who work night shifts, people who have irregular sleep patterns, people who sleep, I think there's a sweet spot of how many hours a day you can sleep. All of these factors do seem to be related with the incidence of heart attacks. But as I said, you have to be careful about attributing causality because this is all observational data.
But a bit like exercise, I'd say that for most people that are listening to this and most people that we know and most people, if we went outside now and gathered a whole load of people up, under the majority of circumstances, getting more sleep wouldn't ever be bad for them.
Yeah, wouldn't be bad. I was up at 6 this morning running, so...
Yeah, well, I was up at 6:45, but I did go to bed at 10, so I had
you did well.
8.5 hours good sleep there, so yeah. And the coffee helps.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you think coffee, because I know, again, endurance athletes like their coffee. Do you think coffee has any impact on heart health? Caffeine in particular.
Again, I'm sure it's observational data about the relationship between caffeine consumption and serious things like heart attacks. The one thing I would say is that caffeine can precipitate palpitations. Mm. So if you're having patients who are having palpitations, excessive caffeine consumption can definitely lead to that. And potentially if you're having atrial fibrillation as well, excess caffeine consumption could precipitate an attack of atrial fibrillation as well.
I always understood that if athletes train when they're ill, so if they have viral conditions, that can sometimes lean to what they call myocarditis, you know, inflammation of the heart wall. Mm-hmm. Am I on the right path there, or is that wrong?
I think as a general principle, we would, rather than talking about athletes specifically, if I had a patient who had myocarditis, I would advise them to avoid anything strenuous.
And how would they know if they have myocarditis? Are there any signs or symptoms?
Generally, patients present with myocarditis with symptoms of chest pain and breathlessness.
So similar to what they might do if they had some of those other heart conditions we talked about. Yeah.
Well, that's why we were saying, you know, if you get symptoms, take it seriously. Athlete or not, you always take it seriously, always seek advice. So if you've got myocarditis, we'd advise against strenuous exercise. We're advising against big increases in heart rate because that can predispose you to subsequent problems. Whether training whilst you're ill leads to inflammation of the heart, or I'm not sure, but I would say, just in terms of common sense, you know, I'd certainly advise against it. You know, training a hard session when you're ill.
I've got a GP coming on next week, actually, and one of the things we're going to talk about is just general immune system care. Yeah. And you know, for me, when I'm ill, I don't really want to train, and I know that I've only got a limited number of white blood cells which can fight infection, but they also help me to repair from training. And if I train while I'm ill, I'm basically dividing my army in two, and so they're going to be less effective at doing either thing. So I'd rather just have a couple of days off, get well, and then train.
Yeah, it sounds very, very logical, very sensible.
Now, there's one other subject which triathletes in particular might be sitting there thinking, I hope Simon asked this question, is there have been incidences in triathlons of people, most of them males actually, who have had heart incidents and passed away during the swim section of a triathlon. Now, my own theory is that they probably haven't warmed up, so their aerobic system hasn't warmed up, their heart's not warmed up. There's a great deal of anxiety and stress about going into water. A lot of people, the majority of triathletes, aren't particularly keen on that, so it's more stressful for them. Mm-hmm. They're in a group of a large group, and so when the gun goes off, a bit like your marathons, most people sprint off to start with, so they're probably going too hard too soon. They're then entering cold water, which we know is going to I know, for instance, when people go out to clear the snow, there's an instance of heart attacks, isn't there, as the airways get constricted. So there's a whole number of factors there that lead, you know, my own assessment is all of those factors combined, and somebody who already has perhaps a predisposed heart condition is, again, am I on the right track there, or am I completely off?
So if we you have to think, if you think about mortality during sport, you really have to think about young people. So people, let's say athletes under the age of 40, and then athletes over the age of 40. Once you get over the age of 40, and particularly in men, the biggest cause of mortality during sport is heart attacks. And that's the main cause of death during sport is heart attacks. We can't necessarily change a lot of those things, because we talked about there's genetic factors, there's the fact that you're a man, there's your age, that are all predisposing factors to a heart attack. And no matter how fit you are, you can still have a heart attack. as you in younger people, the reasons why people die during sport are often genetic problems, heart muscle disease. We call them anomalies of the coronary arteries, where the coronary arteries are taking an unusual path. So these are sort of more, again, they're sort of genetic things or things that you're born with that you can't necessarily do anything about.
But they'd be, but you know, most people in the 20s would, you feel like you're indestructible. So they're probably, they're undiagnosed, aren't they?
Yeah.
And you only ever find out about it when it's too late.
And the problem is, even with screening, the screening that is available in this country through CRY and other charities, or the screenings that's compulsory in some countries like Italy. And I know that in France you have to have an ECG before you can run a marathon, that sort of thing. That might not detect a lot of these things. And a lot of these, you know, and a lot of these very sad cases couldn't have been predicted or prevented beforehand. And sometimes the sport is the precipitating event, but it's hard to say that, you know, in your athlete who's had a heart attack during a marathon or during the triathlon, it's hard to say that they wouldn't have had a heart attack at another time. And it's just the, you know, the underlying factors are still there, and it's this sport that's been the precipitant on that day.
And we could, I mean, my own feeling as a coach is we could sort of mitigate this a little bit. I mean, I take your point that if it's going to happen, it's going to happen, and you could equally be running across the road to get the bus or running up a flight of stairs. But warming up the heart definitely helps. Yeah. Trying to control your stress a little bit by breathing. And if you're really anxious about swimming in the water, maybe hanging back a little bit and not get involved in that melee at the start, and just limiting your stress. And then trying to pace your start so you're not going from a standing start to 60 miles an hour in 5 seconds.
So the stuff we, so in patients who have pre-existing heart disease, when we talk about encouraging it, because in patients who have heart disease, exercise is still incredibly important. And we talk about those patients about how they can exercise safely. And there, the things that we try to avoid are sudden increases in heart rate. So we advise against things like sprinting or lifting heavy weights, things where you get sudden changes in physiology that can put stress on the heart. We advise against that. So I guess you could extrapolate some of that to, you know, the general athlete as well, if you like.
The bottom line here, though, Peter, is we don't want to worry people about all this. You know, heart conditions affect everybody. There's a percentage of the population that's just not going to avoid that, whoever they are, whether it's self-induced or more likely genetic or lifestyle.
Yeah.
So we don't want to scare people into thinking that if they're exercising more, that's going to make them more predisposed. There are certain people, but, you know, likely that the 50-year-old male that's 6'6" has been a rower all his life.
Yeah.
You know, equally, we don't want to scare him because, again, that's only a small percentage, and exercise is better for him than not exercising because he's worried.
Yeah. So the rowing and thing, that's atrial fibrillation.
Right.
So atrial fibrillation in itself is not necessarily dangerous.
Right, okay.
It's not necessarily dangerous. It's more of a nuisance thing that can impair your training.
But you can still train.
Yeah.
Or as long as it's managed, really, and as long as you're sensible. Is that right?
Yeah. So as atrial fibrillation, the way we manage it is with that strategy we talked about before, rate control or rhythm control, and either controlling the rate of the atrial fibrillation or trying to get people out of atrial fibrillation. But atrial fibrillation in itself is not dangerous.
I read somewhere, maybe when I was reading the Haywire Heart, that when you get the atrial fibrillation or atrial flutter, because you're sort of missing a beat, some of the blood pools in the left atrium, and that in itself can predispose you to a heart attack.
To a stroke.
So is that something that somebody who's had atrial fibrillation needs to be concerned about or manage?
So the people at increased risk of stroke with atrial fibrillation, we work it out using a score, but there are things like having diabetes, having high blood pressure, being age over 65, having had a previous heart attack, having a weak heart muscle. Most of these things you probably wouldn't fall into if you're an athlete.
Got you.
And so actually, we wouldn't necessarily normally be giving blood thinners to prevent stroke to athletes, and we would be managing their atrial fibrillation more to do with the rhythm than to do with prevention of stroke. In the general population, it's completely different, and the management of atrial fibrillation is all about preventing stroke. But in the athlete, as I said, because they tend not to have these associated risk factors, we don't worry so much about blood thinning.
Let's see if we can end on a positive note then, yeah. Peter. I mean, you've given us some fantastic information there, and I hope that we've answered all the questions that people have been asking me, and that they might be thinking there. But perhaps if anyone has still got a question that you could answer, maybe we can get them to write to me and I can submit those to you, and then I could do a little short podcast and answer those.
Yeah, or, sure.
I mean, if you've really got a worry about your heart, as you said earlier, go and get it checked out. You know, don't think you're invincible, because it's better to be given the all clear and had a consultation with a cardiologist than to ignore it and just hope that everything's all right. I know certainly in my position, having chatted to you and a couple of other people, that this thing now is not worrying me too much, and I think I'm just going to carry on as I am and put it down as an anomaly. Some practical steps.
Yeah.
See if we can come up with a list of 5 or 6 practical steps that people can take just to safeguard their heart health and ensure that they can carry on exercising to a ripe old age.
So I think number one is take symptoms seriously.
Okay.
I think, you know, if you get symptoms, chest pain, dizziness, blackouts, you need to seek professional help. I think that's really important. Number two is diet and lifestyle. Just because you exercise a lot, don't neglect.
So we're looking at... I mean, there's plenty of evidence about this stuff. It's not like we're telling them anything they don't already know. Eat more vegetables.
Yeah.
Eat less saturated fatty foods. I mean, there is one thing to say is that fats in general, the right sort of fats you get from olive oil, fats you get from avocados, omega-3s, so oily fish, these are good and actually beneficial for your health.
Yes, so I think that's fair. Yeah.
Fats are fine, just too much of the wrong sort of fat isn't fine.
Exactly.
Too much sugar.
Yeah, definitely.
What about salt? I had an interesting question from somebody. They were going to get on a flight and they'd ordered a low salt meal.
Yeah.
Right, on the flight, because they had that option. But at the same time, in order to stay hydrated, and they're probably putting one of these little effervescent salt tablets in. So are they not just taking the salt that they weren't having in the meal and putting it in there? So they're getting the same amount of salt. Yeah. So would they just not be better just having a normal meal and drinking more water?
So what I would say is salt is probably a hugely underestimated risk to public health. And actually, salt intake in the Western world is very strongly linked with blood pressure. And blood pressure is one of the biggest causes of heart attack and stroke in the whole world. And actually, if we could all decrease our salt intake a bit, we would have big benefits to overall health. Having said that, when you're doing sport, you need salt, mainly because you're losing it through sweat.
It always seems to me that if I drink water, that tends to go through me quicker, and I'm going to the bathroom more often. And if I drink water...
Is this in the day or when you're training?
Both, really. I have a little bit of sea salt in my drink now, just during the day, that I tend to hydrate better. And it tends to stay in my system and hydrate my cells rather than I'm going to the toilet a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the same rationale for drinking isotonic drinks. But as I said, the general advice I would be giving people is decrease salt intake.
I guess it's the hidden salt. When people are eating bread and they think that they're eating wholemeal bread and it's healthy, if you take a look at the vitamins and mineral content of each of those, you'll find that on some of those breads that the salt content is actually quite high. Yeah. So it's that hidden salt that we want to be aware of, isn't it? Not perhaps the deliberate salt that we're taking to counteract working out in hot weather.
Definitely.
Okay, so diet and lifestyle. So, and included in that, then we'd be looking at it won't harm to manage stress with some meditation and relaxation. We'd definitely be encouraging more sleep.
So things that are, stress, sleep, are shown to have damaging effects on your heart health. And so it seems sensible to optimize them as much as you can within the confines that we all live very busy lives.
We've got symptoms. We've got diet and lifestyle.
Yeah.
What about some advice around exercise then as we get older? Things that we can keep doing, and we definitely should keep doing, things that perhaps we might not need to be more cautious about.
I think for the general population, I think the advice is that exercise is good. And I think if we're going to give a message, a simple, clear message to everyone, it would be exercise is good.
Okay. Most of my listeners are triathletes and endurance athletes.
When we were talking about the risk of atrial fibrillation, there was some data that suggests that you need to do only athletes who have exercised more than a cumulative amount of 10,000 hours are at risk of atrial fibrillation. So perhaps you could speculate that modulating your volume of training might reduce your risk of atrial fibrillation. But this is logical rather than data-driven advice, that perhaps reducing your, as you get older, perhaps reducing your volume of training and thinking more about quality might be a sensible strategy.
Mm-hmm.
But that's probably sensible, not, for your whole well-being, reducing your risk of injuries, reducing risk of joint injuries, overuse injuries.
I think that's about it. I think probably this last thing I've got a note here that athletes are human. So, just being an athlete doesn't excuse you from getting these problems. Absolutely. You start out as a human and you become an athlete.
Absolutely.
So there's always a potential. So please don't think that you're immune from this just because you do an Ironman. And just because somebody you know does triathlon or runs marathons and has a heart problem, that doesn't automatically increase your risk either. So there's no need to be worried by what's in the popular press, because often the press loves to make a meal of the fact that this guy had a heart attack while he was doing triathlon, and then everybody says, well, there's the proof that it's bad for you. It's definitely not.
Yeah, and I would say that I was just looking at this the other day. The incidence of cardiac arrest during marathon running is about 0.5 per 100,000 marathon runners. So tiny, tiny numbers.
Well, and you know what as well? The day after London Marathon, if three people have died out of, 30,000 runners, that percentage is tiny.
Mm-hmm.
Think of all the lives that have been enriched and made healthier through people taking up running and entering into London Marathon.
Yeah.
Way more than those three sad cases where people have passed away. But as you said earlier, people who may have had a heart incident at work and therefore would never have been heard about.
Yeah.
The press makes a big deal of it. We all start to think that running's unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
But if they publicised the 3,000 lives that had been made healthier, that would be far more significant and far more beneficial for the health service and the medical profession in general.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the message that I want to, that I give all of my patients as a general principle is exercise is good. And exercise is actually the cheapest medicine that we have. And it's the cheapest way we can make you live longer and have a healthier, richer life.
Brilliant place to finish, Peter. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
It's been great. And I know you've got some more research studies coming up, and some of the listeners on this show may well be interested and may well be the right population for that. So please do keep listening in, and when Peter's recruiting, I'll definitely be putting a post out there. So some of you guys particularly might be interested in that. I will ask you one question, Peter, before you go. A lot of females say to me, why do we get overlooked with research? Why are all the studies done on men?
In terms of veteran athletes?
In terms of sports and fitness, why are most studies performed on male subjects?
I can only talk about our research. And when we were looking at young, fit athletes, the reason that it's easier to study men is because they have more profound changes in their heart. That because the heart's bigger, they have more changes, and therefore it's easier to study. It's easier for us to detect changes. And that's the reason we tend to focus on men. Also, perhaps there's effect of testosterone as well.
About monthly cycle and changes in hormones? Does that affect control studies and comparison?
Not sure. But so that's that. When you look at the veteran athlete, the reason we study men is because it's the men that seem to have the problems.
Right.
You know, it's the men that seem to be more at risk of this, the scarring of the heart. It's men that seem to be more at risk of atrial fibrillation. So that's the main reason we concentrate on men. But we're not overlooking women. There are studies ongoing for, you know, for young female endurance athletes and for female veteran athletes. So there is lots of stuff on the female athlete's heart too.
Great. Okay. Well, listen, Peter, thanks so much. Been an absolute fantastic insight into heart health and some of the research you've been doing. All the best with that. Please do let us know when you were recruiting again, and I'll definitely share that. Listeners, that's it from me. I'm over and out for this week, but please do check in next week when I'll have another fantastic guest for you. Enjoy the rest of your week.
That's a wrap for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening to the conversation, and I hope you learned at least one thing. If this is the first time you've listened in, please go back and take a listen to some of our previous guests, and I can guarantee they will be just as good as the one you've just heard. If you've been a regular listener, then thank you for being a part of this journey with me so far. Finally, I'd like to take just a few seconds to tell you about my SWOT Inner Circle program. In the last few years, I spent an awful lot of time creating training programs and resources to help you train and race at whatever triathlon distance you choose. And for some of the events outside of triathlon like aquabike, duathlon and swimrun events. As a SWOT member, you get access to all of these plans for 12 months of the year. And on top of that, we provide guidance on strength and conditioning, nutrition, plus a whole host of other supportive activities which help you to train, recover and race better. We also have a really friendly Facebook community. It's an exclusive Facebook page for SWOT members only, and there are over 150 of them already. If you join, you'll be able to get access to that page and you'll be able to ask for help, and our members are all too happy to provide guidance and advice based on their experiences. I'll also be there to help you find solutions to your training problems, and all you have to do is tag me in the Facebook page in one of your posts, or you can book a 15-minute phone call should you need one. If you'd like more information, or if you're ready to press the button and join the SWOT Inner Circle, just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send you all of the details. So that's all for this week. Hopefully I'll see you again next week, same time, same place, with a different guest.